The threat of methamphetamine in Iowa is not what it used to be, but meth continues to ruin lives and destroy families. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll hear from an Iowa mother who kicked the meth habit to regain custody of her seven children. She now works for an effective state service called the Parent Partner Program to battle meth. Also on the program, Paul Feddersen with Narcotics Enforcement at the Iowa Department of Public Safety, and Jay Hansen of Prairie Ridge Integrative Behavioral Health Care will talk about treating meth addiction. Has meth addiction touched your family, your life? Join our discussion. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The threat of meth and methamphetamine labs here in Iowa isn't what it used to be. It has diminished from the peak of the problem, I'll say about 10 years ago. But meth continues to ruin lives and destroy families in our communities across the state, in the Midwest, in the nation. In the words of Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley at a recent Des Moines hearing on the subject, some may think meth is yesterday's problem, but he noted that record numbers of Iowans are seeking treatment for meth addiction, and prison authorities are seeing more new inmates whose crimes are related to this drug. This hour, we want to reacquaint ourselves with the problem of meth addiction, and talk about what's being done about it. We'd like to have you join our conversation. Has meth addiction touched your life? Perhaps a family member? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us for the entire hour, Denise Moore is with us, Service Area Coordinator for the Iowa Department of Human Services Parent Partner Program through Children and Families. We'll have her tell us what that program is about. She is a former meth addict as well. Denise, you're in Des Moines. Welcome to our program.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming into our studio. Also in our Des Moines studio, Paul Feddersen, Assistant Director of Narcotics Enforcement at the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Paul Feddersen, welcome to you.
Thanks, sir.
And Jay Hansen joins us by phone, Executive Director of Prairie Ridge Integrative Behavioral Health Care. Jay, hello.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Yeah, we're just into the afternoon. Okay, let's start off with you, Denise. You gave testimony, shared your personal experience recently. I'd like to start off, before we get to the program that you're helping to coordinate, to tell us your story. You were arrested for conspiracy to deliver meth and faced having your seven children taken away from you. Before we get to the point of the arrest, tell us about your life leading up to the arrest. I understand you grew up in Sheraton in South, is that South Central Iowa? When did you start abusing substances?
Well, I'd like to say that I come from a world and a culture of substance abuse and domestic violence. So it kind of led me into that path at a very young age. I started using substances at 12 years old. I continued down that path for some time until it escalated to where I was selling drugs to maintain my habit and take care of my family.
Mm-hmm. How often in that period before your first arrest did you think, I really shouldn't be doing this? There are grave consequences, well, for my health, for what I'm doing to my family, but also should I get arrested, which you eventually were. Did that cross your mind?
Yes, it absolutely. I remember thinking years before that time, how will I ever stop using drugs? Mm-hmm. It had become such a lifestyle for me. I was so submersed in it. I had to use just to get up out of bed in the morning. So I was completely submersed in that lifestyle. So absolutely, I thought, how will I ever be able to do it? I did not know how to live sober, it was one of the most difficult things for me was learning how to do things sober and to build a life. And
did you at this time before the arrest, did your kids everybody in the family know what was going on with you? Were you hiding this?
Yeah, my children knew. They were, you know, and that's another thing. They knew what was going on. I think they were very ashamed of it. You know, they would have to come home before they brought their kids home or their friends home to make sure there wasn't anything laying out or that I wasn't all strung out or I was a lot behind a bedroom door. So they knew what was happening.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the day of the arrest and what happened right after that?
Well, I was gone from the house, and when I came home, my house had been raided or was being raided. I had sold some drugs to an undercover policeman, and they had me. He was wired, and he had come back, so I kind of knew they were coming, but I had no idea. So all my kids were home. They were all lined up on the couch, and my house was being went through.
Mm-hmm. I understand in your testimony you talked about your children all being lined up on the couch, including a brand-new baby, I assume being held by one of the other children. And you were told that you had to tell them that you were going to be gone.
Yeah, and that was further into the case. When I got arrested, I was out pretty quickly because my family knew that DHS was coming, and we were so scared of the kids being removed and sent to different foster homes. So they got me out pretty quickly. And when DHS did come, they kept my kids together in that same home, which is kind of unheard of in 2003. And I had to leave. But so during that process, I kind of did what I've always known how to do, and that was go get high. I didn't know how to live any other way. I had no job. I was homeless. I had no education. I didn't have a driver's license. So I kind of languished out there for a long time until I was at termination of my parental rights. And that's when my worker lined all my children up on the couch, and I had to tell them that I was going to lose them forever.
Mm-hmm. But then at some point you said in your testimony, an angel came to my door. Who was that angel? What did that angel do?
Absolutely. So that was my assessment worker. And I was so fearful and scared of the system that I just knew that when DHS came in, they were going to remove my kids and I was never going to get them back. Mm-hmm. And she came in and she seen my kids. As a unit, she kept them together. She knew that the best thing for them was to keep them all together, even though it was in a drug house, thinking outside the box, how bringing my mom in. So in a matter of 45 minutes, I was out on the streets and my mom was in with my kids. My kids got to stay in the same school. They got to stay with their friends. They had the same coaches. They just had my mom. The only thing that was missing was me, and it was critical for the success of them to have each other during that time.
So you didn't think you would be given a chance, but you were given a chance. What were the conditions under which you moved forward there with your family as a unit?
So, well, I had to be supervised. I had supervised visits with them, and I had to go to treatment. I went to treatment.
Did you serve any prison time?
No. So I got put on probation, but it seemed like if I was doing what I needed to do for DHS, that my probation just kind of went away. So I didn't have to do – I just got put on probation, which was a saving grace for me because I was looking at 25 years. But my family – today is so successful because of the interventions of them being able to stay together, of my children being able to stay together and support each other through that process.
It's more than 10 years ago, so you have kids, grown-up kids.
Yes,
and it's so wonderful to hear you say that they're doing well.
Oh, they're amazing. So I'm very, very proud.
Very good. A story with a happy ending. Let's talk about the program that you coordinate for the Iowa Department of Human Services called the Parent Partner Program through Children and Families. How does it work? What is it?
Okay, so parents that have had their children removed, they have to meet certain eligibility requirements, but they have to resolve whatever issues brought them to the attention of the department. So whether that was substance abuse, and the majority of our clients are addicted to substances, and most of our parent partners are also in recovery as well. Mm-hmm. So they have to have a certain amount of clean time. They have to their case has to be closed. They have to be reunited with their children for a year or resolved whatever issues brought them to the attention of the department. Then we go put them through training. They have several different trainings that they need to go to before they can start mentoring. And then as soon as a child or a family just comes into the system, a parent partner is matched with that family that is coming in.
Mm-hmm. And a parent partner is a former addict.
Yes, mm-hmm. It can be. There's also, I mean, there's multiple issues, and our parent partners work with everything from physical abuse, sexual abuse. They work through whatever brings the family to the system. It's based on the shared experience of having your kids removed,
yep.
And then they're able to mentor them through that process.
What impact has this program made? How many families have been helped this way?
Well, just this year, we've over 1,600 families.
1,600?
Yes. And
in Iowa?
Yes. Mm. And we're in all 99 counties. So, and I think that what the most important thing that they do is provide a sense of hope to families, because families come in scared and fearful of the system. They don't understand what's happening. They don't understand what the system is. The system kind of speaks a different language than families do. So our parent partners are able to help families understand, take away some of that fear so they're able to move forward and achieve sobriety or whatever issue.
Is it always successful?
Well, no, it's not always successful. And I think, you know, people need to be ready to be able to mm-hmm. change their life. Some have suffered so much trauma that they have a lot of issues that they need to work through. And we have time frames within our child welfare system that families need to get their act together. And if they don't meet that, then they're looking at adoption or termination of their rights.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a rate of success that you can quote?
I do know that we've had a 5-year evaluation from the University of Nebraska, and they took administrative data from the department and matched it with parent partners or families that have had parent partners versus families that don't have parent partners. And the families that have had parent partners are more likely to reunify and less likely to come back into the system.
Okay, but you don't know, like a 50-50 chance, or is it better than 50-50 chance? You don't know.
I don't have the actual numbers.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about meth addiction in Iowa. If it's touched your family, your life, you can join our conversation. Have you gotten help? Did that help come after an arrest? What are your thoughts about how our state treats meth addiction? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. Paul Feddersen, Assistant Director of Narcotics Enforcement at the Iowa Department of Public Safety. You've been in law enforcement, I understand, for some 21 years, the majority of it in narcotics investigations. Let's get a current picture of what's going on with meth in Iowa. Trending up, trending down, how bad is the threat?
Well, it's a little bit different. We talk about the meth labs here in Iowa today. And back in 2004, there were approximately 1,500 meth labs a year that were seized. Mm. And currently today, we're down to about 130 to this date. So there's been quite a drop in the number of meth labs in Iowa. So that's a great sign and good hope for Iowa.
What was the key to keeping those meth labs from popping up?
In 2005, there was Iowa legislation passed limiting the availability of pseudoephedrine, and that's a key ingredient to right. manufacturing methamphetamine.
So, and that was the one key thing?
Yes, that helped a lot.
So when you have to pop your driver's license out, and you may wonder why at the pharmacy it's really doing good.
Yes. Yeah, that's been a great success, and I think that's what has attributed a lot to the down numbers in meth labs.
Okay, so these remaining 130 this last fiscal year, why are they still there? How come we can't do anything about those?
Well, these meth labs today and back then, they manufacture their smaller quantities of meth. It's probably less than 5% of the methamphetamine here in Iowa is manufactured here. I think it's even less than that.
This is domestic manufacturing, less than 5%.
Yes.
Okay.
Here in Iowa. Mm-hmm. So,
and you can It wasn't too long ago I heard this made national news, a man arrested for cooking meth in his pants in some kind of bottle. Did you hear that?
No, I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, it made national news. I assume you can make this in a 2-liter Coke bottle or soda bottle, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's very easy.
Mm-hmm. The emergence of one-cook pots in the production of meth, what is that?
Well, you know, it's just changed over the years. You know, it's basically manufacturing yet, but just the process has changed. And I can't tell you exactly step by step. We have some people who are specialized in the meth lab, meth labs and dismantling them. But basically, all the ingredients are put into one bottle, and they call it the shake and bake, and it manufactures through that system.
Mm-hmm. And there is still, as before, always a risk of fire and explosions. How many of those, the meth fires, explosions, do we see here in Iowa?
You know, I don't think we've seen a lot lately. I don't have the numbers. But I know they've significantly increased from, you know, back in 2004 and those earlier years when there was just a significant amount of those meth labs around.
Decreased.
Yes, decreased.
Yep. Decreased. So if less than 5% is being manufactured here in Iowa, and Iowa was known at one point, sort of 10 years ago, am I correct, Paul Feddersen, as one of the meth production capitals in the 50 states, right?
Yeah, we had one of the highest numbers of meth labs seized, you know, back in that time frame. But, you know, obviously it's decreased, you know, at this point.
Mm-hmm. So 95%, over 95% coming from outside of Iowa, where from?
Mexico. Mexico and the southwest borders is where it's coming from. These major drug trafficking organizations you know, are bringing it across the border in the southwest border states, you know, including California, and then it just disperses throughout the United States from that point.
Okay, and in when it's transported, it's in the form of what?
Just a crystal substance.
A crystal substance. So it can be hidden in any parts of cars or whatever vehicle you have.
Correct. It can also come in liquid, but yeah, I mean, it's moved through the United States through vehicles, postal. FedEx packages, you know, any sort of vehicle, trucks and tractor trailers.
Mm-hmm. What has happened to, well, let's talk about the cost and the quality of the meth, the purity of the meth. What has happened to the cost in the last, say, decade?
You know, back in like 2009, 1 pound of methamphetamine would cost anywhere from $27,000 to $32,000 for 1 pound. And today, methamphetamine, you know, you can buy a pound of meth from $10,000 to $14,000 is what it's going to cost you. So the price has decreased significantly.
Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of a pound, you know, those who thankfully don't use meth or aren't acquainted with it at all. What is a pound? How far does that go? How many people get high off of a pound or how many uses are there?
You know, I couldn't. I don't think anybody can tell you that. I mean, a pound is a lot. It's like going to Costco, and when you're, you know, buying a certain product there to last you quite a while. I mean, that's what it is. But nobody buys 1 pound of methamphetamine just to hang on to.
Oh, really? Okay, this is not 1 pound for this is for a lot of people.
Yes, yeah, mm-hmm. Distribution.
Tell us, can you tell us about the cost to us in terms of law enforcement? What this meth problem still means for us in those terms?
Well, the actual cost, you know, I don't know for law enforcement. You know, as a state as a whole, you know, you're talking about prevention, treatment, you know, and the drug enforcement side, I mean, for controlled substances. So, you know, I don't know the cost, but, mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure it's expensive.
So there's a cost of enforcement, but then you have to have their meth labs discovered. You have to clean those up, and there are some chemicals around there, I assume. The price of meth dropping, purity rising?
Yes, purity has jumped up. On average now, you know, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation Laboratory tests the methamphetamine here in Iowa, and on average it's 98% pure. You know, compared to 10 years ago, it was anywhere from 14% to 40% methamphetamine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's jumped significantly.
As what does your day-to-day activity look like, and the people who work are supervised by you in the narcotics enforcement area of Iowa Department of Public Safety?
You know, basically the agents with the Iowa Division of Narcotics Enforcement, they work with hand in hand with the city and county officers and federal officers daily, along with the Drug Task Force, is just conducting narcotics investigations, anywhere from surveillance to search warrants to undercover transactions, and that's, you know, daily that's what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. What is most effective in finding people who are dealing meth? What sort of operations?
You know, surveillance, you know, can get a lot of information, and just receiving information from the public helps. You know, daily, public people from the public are calling law enforcement and giving information about individuals that they feel are doing criminal activity and possible drug activity.
Really? So what should we be looking for? What are red flags? What are signs that maybe a house in your neighborhood is engaged in this sort of thing?
You know, what we see a lot of the public that call in or email in is they may have a neighbor that has a lot of short-time traffic where various cars will show up. Somebody will go in, come out, you know, within 30 seconds to a minute, and it's just like a rotating door there. And that brings a lot of suspicion to people who call in, and that's a pretty good sign of some sort of criminal activity taking place.
I imagine, though, you have a hesitancy. Maybe you don't know them, or you don't want to call the police, and it may be something else. I don't know. They may have some kind of craft that they produce in their house and they sell a lot of. You know, I'm just trying to think here. People may be hesitant and say, you know, I don't know what's going on there. I don't want to mess around in that business. Would there be consequences there? Or should
No. I mean, anybody who calls in, obviously, we don't know who's calling in, and it you know, we have to verify the information, and we take. We just take the information, try to verify what they're saying. We conduct surveillance and things like that. And like you said, it could be nothing. But at least, you know, if somebody feels there possibly could be something, you know, some criminal activity, the safest way is to report it to local law enforcement, and they can investigate it. And most people are, you know, they don't tell us their name, which is totally fine. They can remain anonymous, and we just look into it, and if there's nothing there, there's nothing there.
What do you see in the future, in the next few months, next few years here? Do we see us staying at sort of 130 busted meth labs here in Iowa? Or
yeah, I think it will, you know, stay the same or even go down, decrease from here. It's been decreasing every year, and I don't have all the numbers in front of me, but every year it's been decreasing. So, you know, I don't think we'll ever get to zero. You know, I don't think that's going to happen. But it is decreasing, and that's a good sign.
Paul Feddersen is with us. He's Assistant Director of Narcotics Enforcement at the Iowa Department of Public Safety. We're getting an update on the problem of meth in Iowa. It has decreased quite a bit, as Paul described a little bit earlier, back in the heyday, if you want to use that term, of meth in 2004, 1,500 labs here in Iowa busted. Now we're down to about 130, if I remember those figures correctly. Denise Moore is with us, Service Area Coordinator for the Iowa Department of Human Services Parent Partnering Partner Program, through children and families. When meth addicts are discovered, keeping them with their families, finding the most effective treatment there. And that's what we want to concentrate on when we come back. Jay Hansen is with us as well, of Prairie Ridge Integrative Behavioral Health Care. We want to get into the nuts and bolts of what a meth addiction does to your brain and what we found out about how best to treat it. Has meth touched your life, your family? Have you gotten help? Did a loved one get help? Did that help come only after an arrest? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us midstream on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about meth addiction in Iowa. We know the threat of meth and methamphetamine labs here in Iowa isn't what it used to be. It's diminished from the peak, the bad days around 10 years ago when meth was really a problem across the Midwest and particularly here in Iowa. 1,500 meth labs were discovered and busted about 10 years ago in 1 year. An important law was enacted that is something to do with making sure that these chemicals are not available through the pharmacy in mass quantities. And we're still talking about, though, meth continuing to ruin lives, destroy families in our communities across the state. Joining us to talk about it in 2015, Denise Moore, Area Service Area Coordinator for the Iowa Department of Human Services Parent Partner Program. And she's a former meth addict who gave up meth and was able to hold on to her seven children by doing so. Paul Feddersen, Assistant Director for Narcotics Enforcement at the Iowa Department of Public Safety, and Jay Hansen, Executive Director of Prairie Ridge Integrative Behavioral Healthcare. Join our conversation with your questions, your comments, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Jay Hansen, let's talk to you. Executive Director of the Prairie Ridge Integrative Behavioral Healthcare. You deal with helping people kick this addiction. Tell us about your services as they relate to meth abuse and addiction.
We serve approximately 3,000 people a year. 20% of those admissions are methamphetamine related, which is a little bit more than it has been in the past few years. So we're not seeing a huge increase in meth admissions, but they are gradually starting to climb. I think previous years they ranged from 14 to the current 19%. Treatment for methamphetamine is very similar to treatment for other substances. I think because people are so overstimulated, we often have to make sure that we're matching people with the right dosage of treatment, because they may not be able to tolerate a residential environment, or say they may need sleep, fewer appointments early on. So the treatment is fairly typical. It's skill building, relapse prevention, and getting them to begin the healing process in terms of their brain and the rest of their body.
Mm-hmm. You said up slightly the number of people coming in compared to people coming in for other substance abuse to your program. Any idea why there would be a slight climb from, say, 14-15% to near 20%?
While the meth labs have certainly decreased, and I think the Sudafed law was really important, it's clear that the supply of meth has increased. And, you know, you can assume that because of the price drop, as Paul talked about. I did a focus group with 10 methamphetamine users in treatment prior to the congressional testimony, and they've indicated that it's just been flipped, that most of the meth available before the law was made in Iowa. Now, as Paul mentioned, most of it's coming from Mexico. And the price point, you know, some of them mentioned that there's so much of it out there that they're giving an extra ounce when people are buying as a premium to keep their customers. So, you know, I think when there's a demand for something and there'll be a supply, and I think probably in Iowa we could say that there's actually an oversupply.
Hmm. So would you say compared to 10, 15 years ago, when we would say meth was at its peak in terms of domestic manufacturing, that we have, it doesn't sound like we've come very far in when you describe it this way.
It's just a matter of supply and demand. If there is demand, there'll be supply. The Mexican drug cartels will make sure of that. And so the demand for it is not affected by the lack of availability.
Mm-hmm. Can you necessarily identify a meth user when you meet them? You have the expertise to.
There are certain symptoms, physical symptoms. Certainly, because it's such a strong central nervous system stimulant, there may be loss of weight, jitteriness, agitation, but not in everyone. I think there are many people who use meth who don't seek treatment, who you know, look pretty much like somebody you and I would run into on the street.
Mm-hmm. Denise Moore, as a former meth addict, do you think you stuck out when you went out in public, or did you make sure you didn't?
Well, yeah, I thought that I didn't. I thought that I looked normal, but looking back, I definitely stuck out.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
I think, well, you're skinny, withdrawn, your face gets sunk in, depending on, I guess, what drugs you're using or what kind of meth you're using, you would get sores on your face and stuff. I didn't get that a lot, but you can definitely tell. And then it's how you use it. If somebody's using meth intravenously, it's much more shocking. Their appearance is much more shocking.
Okay, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Kenny is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Kenny. What is your connection to meth? Kenny, are you there?
Is this my stuff?
Yeah, we can hear you, Kenny. Go ahead.
The connection with meth is, the point I'm trying to make is the reason why meth dealers can make a lot of money off of it is because some of it is bogus. And people will not get high on the first try. And so they keep coming back to buy more. I have tried it one time, and I tried it two times in one day, and nothing at all happened. And so I think for some people, the addiction does not start with the meth itself. It starts with the expectation. So they think, well, I'm going to get really high. Well, it didn't work on my first try. Well, I'll try it again. And if they're not being smart about it, then they're going to say, well, it didn't work on the second try either. I'll try it again. And that's how the people are making money, is by selling bogus stuff.
Kenny, you say you used meth. How far did it go with you? Did you get addicted?
Not at all, because nothing happened.
Okay. So you're done with meth?
Absolutely. I mean, why would you pay something for nothing twice?
Okay. Jay Hansen, I wonder if you can clue us in. Thank you, Kenny, for sharing that from Des Moines, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can share over our Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page as well, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Tell us about how meth works in the brain.
Well, like most drugs, it creates a release of dopamine in the brain, and that's the pleasure center, the limbic system. That's the same area that has helped our species survive through reward. So the reason it feels good to eat when you're hungry is that there's a reward. But sex feels good, a procreation of our species feels good when you're thirsty and you drink water, feels good when you're around people and get your nurturance. So those things have been set up in our brain to be naturally rewarding, so people seek those things over again. It's the same system, the limbic system, that involves dopamine in the brain, especially with meth. Meth is indistinguishable by the brain from dopamine, and so it releases huge amounts of dopamine. At baseline, research has shown that sex will produce dopamine at a level of 150 per unit, cocaine 350, and methamphetamine 1,250. So
wow.
You see just how addictive and how much dopamine is released. And the trouble is, once that happens, the first time, the absolute first time a person uses, the brain will start to compensate. It will say, this is too much of a good thing, and will automatically, immediately start to reduce the production of natural dopamine and block some of the receptor sites that take up dopamine. And so not only is the first meth experience usually very pleasurable, your body already is adjusting and leaving the person with even less dopamine than they had before that first use. And that continues every time they use. So it results in an addiction. If you were 200 feet down underwater and you knew you weren't going to make it to the top, and your brain was saying to yourself at the intellectual level, if you breathe, you're going to die. And yet people breathe because there is that irresistible urge to perform an irrational act. That's what addiction is. And I think that's why it's often misunderstood, is people don't understand just how strong this craving and urge is, and that it's very much a brain disease from that standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Denise Moore, does that sound familiar to you, being 200 feet below the surface of water and you knowing that if you breathe, you'll die, but you do it anyway?
Absolutely. I knew what I was doing to myself and to my family. I just didn't know how to change it. And the only thing that I knew how to do, or that would ease the pain, and most of it was just trying to hide any kind of feelings I might have from my own childhood was to get high, and to the point where I couldn't even get out of bed without doing it.
Mm-hmm. Jay Hansen, so what is the key? What are the keys to breaking an addiction in most people?
I think, like Denise has mentioned, I think there needs to be a time where a person gets a chance to look at the consequences of their substance use.
They have to reach rock bottom and really, in Denise's case, would have had to give up 7 children.
Yes. I don't think it has to be rock bottom, but I think that's something that people can do in relation to drug use, is let people know when they're seeing negative consequences. So really what treatment is about is it's making that irresistible urge resistible, and that's how treatment works, with skills and those kind of things. So it is important to stop people and say, let's take a look at this. What are the pros and cons of this? I think what people don't often understand is that addiction, most people in the throes of addiction don't want to continue to use substances. Yeah. The last thing they really want to do, but it's this craving and urge that, you know, the breathing underwater issue.
Denise Moore, how long have you been clean?
Over 10 years.
Over 10 years. Congratulations.
Thank you.
When was the last time you had a moment when you said to yourself, geez, I would sure love to do some meth?
10 years ago.
Really?
I've never wanted to. I never wanted to go back. I was given many, many opportunities to change my life in a different way. And so every day I'm grateful for the life I've been given.
What was the switch? Describe the switch that went on in your brain. I'll just say switch, perhaps more sophisticated than that. But what was the point at which you said, I'm not never going back? What changed?
When I was going to lose something that was more important to me than drugs, and that was my children.
And yet, while you were addicted, you were impacting your children in a negative way, and you knew it.
Yeah, but I guess I wasn't facing the fact that I was going to lose them forever. Hmm. And you know, and shortly after, I was given a path through the department to work on programs and build skills and go to school. And through every step that I took, the further away I got from that world and the less likely I was to go back.
1-866-780-9100. Jake is joining us as we talk about meth addiction in Iowa in 2015. Hi, Jake.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Go ahead, Jake.
I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I've been doing it for 36 years, and so I've seen the growth of meth. And I just would like to comment that I think our legislature has to figure it out that instead of incarcerating people at $35,000 a year, we need to look at community-based drug courts as a solution to this addiction problem, because the reason all this Mexican meth is coming in is there's a demand for it. And this revolving door of sending people to prisons on mandatory minimum sentences is just not working.
Hmm. Okay, Jake, thank you for your perspective as a criminal defense attorney for drug addicts. What do you have to say about that? Jay, Paul, Denise, the resources that we currently have, the laws that we currently have, are they adequate? Jump in. Jay?
Yeah, I think he makes a good point. I think the resources that could be available to treat people, the success rates with meth are just as good as any other substance. About half first try make major changes. So I do think, you know, working more with drug courts, we have a drug court here in Mason City. I like drug courts because it kind of puts both the criminal justice system and the treatment system together. If a person is interested in getting better, there's a path out. If they're not interested, then there's a consequence. And so I think the caller makes a good point.
Anyone else want to jump in on that point?
Well, I would agree. I believe that what we've done so far hasn't worked. I mean, terminating rights and incarcerating people, it just isn't. It isn't getting to the core of their issue. And so when they come back out of incarceration, they go back to the same world doing the same thing. So unless we treat whatever symptoms or whatever brought the reasoning for them using and showing them a way how to live differently, they're just going to continue doing the same thing. So I totally agree.
As we wind up our conversation on meth addiction, meth abuse, meth treatment in Iowa, I wanted to ask a little bit about popular culture and meth. Of course, Breaking Bad, a hugely popular series on cable TV. Have you watched it before, Denise?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? Realistic or too much glamorizing or perhaps the opposite of that?
That's a pretty elaborate setup they got there. That might have been a little out of my league. So, I do believe that it's glamorizing a little bit. You know, I'm not sure how – I've been out of the scene for a long time, so I really don't know what it's like out there right now. But it seems like it does glamorize it a little bit.
Jay Hansen, have you watched the series?
Yeah, I have.
Mm-hmm. What is your reaction to it?
I think one of the interesting things is most of the meth that comes here now is ice, which is the form that was portrayed in the show. It used to be more powder. And so I think that may have had an impact in terms of the way, what's being made and from the purity standpoint. So I think it was a fairly decent portrayal.
1-866-780-9100. Elaine is joining us from Waverly. Hi, Elaine. What is your connection to meth?
I had a unique experience. I was a single mother involved with a great guy who had another son who I'd witnessed him as just being completely devoted and attentive to. And so I had a lot of faith, you know, going into the pregnancy. But due to a lot of pressure on him, the months and 2 months I was postpartum, he developed a really serious meth addiction and basically completely dropped out of our lives to the point that my family sort of had to intervene and take me and my son away. And it was, you know, a pretty harrowing time for me being postpartum and all of that. But my son and I are doing so well now. And after a few months of treatment at a facility in New York, my son's father is back in our lives and is working harder than ever and has been clean. And similar to your guest, he said, he would never go back. You know, he said it was amazing to be knowing the entire time how badly he was hurting his family and almost just, you know, not really being able to face the reality of what he was actually doing.
Elaine, I'm so glad that has a happy story, a very painful but then happy ending. We're so glad you shared it with us, Elaine in Waverly.
Yes, thank you.
Jay Hansen, as someone who works with meth addicts, how does meth addiction, you talked about the degree, the dopamine that is produced by the brain, the various levels, and meth creates a lot of pleasure. How does it compare with other addictions in getting over it? And let's talk about tobacco, alcohol, heroin, for instance.
Yeah, I talked with Dr. Steve Arndt from the University of Iowa Research Consortium, and he indicated that the data that they have used over the past 20-some years, meth is just as easy to treat, or just the results are equal to marijuana and other drugs. So it's something that is comparable to whatever substance you might be treating.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about the big picture of substance abuse in Iowa, illegal drugs, legal drugs, is alcohol still the biggest culprit in destroying lives and families out there?
By far. There's no question about it. Half of the admissions in Iowa are alcohol-related, and in terms of the difficulties and carnage, equally on par with meth.
Mm-hmm. Denise Moore, before we go, I wanted to ask about your relationship with your kids now, some of them quite grown up. Do you talk about that time with them now?
Oh yeah, they know everything. My kids are extremely proud of me. They've seen me come from there to where I'm at today. I get to speak nationally and across our state, and we've broken the cycle of addiction. So they're extremely proud, and we are pretty open about everything that happened.
Still painful to talk about it though?
Not as much. We've all went through the healing process together, so we're pretty healed from it.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing to me sometimes, but you know, they never stopped loving me for one single minute.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Do you see how that experience has shaped their lives? I imagine they're very streetwise.
Actually, it's affected in a different way. My kids they don't use drugs. They've graduated from high school. They go into college. They're having healthy relationships. They're building home, or they're buying homes. They're building families. So it actually had the opposite effect with my kids. And I owe that to the interventions that were done for me and for them. So yeah, I'm pretty proud of the kids.
That sounds like you should well be proud of the kids and the people that helped you, the state people that helped you when you were addicted. It sounds like a great story, and I'm glad you do speak out nationally about it. Denise Moore, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us this hour, Jay Hansen, Executive Director of the Prairie Ridge Integrative Behavioral Health Care. Jay, when people want to find out about treatment, where can they go on the web?
They can go to Prairie Ridge. If they're looking here, go to the Iowa Department of Public Health website as well. There's a bureau there that coordinates substance use disorder care.
Okay, very good. Paul Federson, thank you very much for joining us, Assistant Director of Narcotics Enforcement at the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Sounds like quite a challenge out there still.
Yes, thanks for having me this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Okay, River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth in Des Moines. Help from John Pemble. Our executive producer of talk shows is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this or any other program. You can email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.